Last week, I spoke to you about the rise of the development theory. Just before that, we ended our survey of the documentary theory of its development to Hupfeldt with noticing what Hupfeldt maintained. And I hope you all have in mind that Hupfeldt's theory was the modified document hypothesis that there were three documents instead of two in the first four books of the Old Testament. That is, leaving Deuteronomy to the side. In the first four books, there were three documents. These three documents, one was, he called the first Elohim. Today they call it P. One he called the second Elohim. Today they call it E. The other he called the Jehovah's. Today they call it J. And of these three documents, Hupfeldt did not particularly raise a question as to which was first. He probably assumed that the first Elohist was first, and then either the second Elohist or the Jehovahist, both of them being later than the first Elohist. And however, Hupfeldt thought that somebody had these three documents before him and took sections from one, sections from a second, sections from the first, sections from the third, sections from the second, sections from the third, and so on, and interlaced them together. And this man who took these and interlaced them together, according to present-day terminology, would be called a redactor. A redactor, that's a term you'll find in any discussion of the higher criticism. A redactor, a man who takes documents and fits them together. Now, the redactor naturally has to make some changes. He may not make many. There's great difference of opinion. Some would say the redactor has made a great many changes. Others would say the redactor has made very few changes. He's simply taken the documents as he found them and put them together. As you read the critics today, sometimes you think this redactor was an utter idiot. Some of them even say he was. Because he put things together that just clashed so completely, they pulled. Contradict each other so definitely that any fool would have sense enough to see they don't belong together. And others, at times they speak of the redactor as if he was a very, very clever man who fit them together so nicely that it takes tremendous study to see how they separate and to notice the little changes the redactor made in each of them in order to fit them together. We'll have much to say later on about redactors. All we want now is to be sure you know what we mean by a redactor. And then we started Roman numeral 4, the rise of the development theory, going back and paralleling what we had to say about the partition theory. The rise of the development theory. And then I gave you number 1 and didn't give you the heading A, which should come before 1, between 4 and 1, of course. A would be its general course. The general course during that period of the development theory. Number 1, I told you, was Divetti, who as a young man in 1805 issued his thesis that the book of Deuteronomy is the law book that Josiah found in the temple. Not something written by Moses many centuries before Josiah, but something that was written at the time of Josiah, reflects the background of Josiah's day, and represents the plans and methods that Josiah used in the Reformation that the book of Kings tells us that Josiah carried out. Now that that idea about Deuteronomy remained among critical scholars, accepted with hardly a challenge until about 1920. And since 1920, there have been various scholars who have suggested that Deuteronomy was written much later than that. And there have been other scholars who have suggested that Deuteronomy was written much earlier than that. But most critical books will assume that Divetti was right, and that Deuteronomy was written at about the time of Josiah. Perhaps right then, perhaps a little before. But that is what is assumed by most critical books. And you see, this is the one point then where you have a definite chronological connection for the documentary theory. If Deuteronomy was written in the time of Josiah, that gives you a fixed point to which to relate other matters. Now, Divetti went on to say the Pentateuch has no history. It has only legend and poetry. in it. None of it is historical, none of it is dependable and true, but DeVetti was a highly devotional man, a man who spoke very piously, a man whose sermons people found very edifying, and the fact that he didn't believe anything of the factual statements in the Old Testament did not, in the eyes of uneducated people, detract from his standing as a great religious leader. Did I mention number two, Vatke? Capital V-A-T-K-E. We're not going to say a great deal about Vatke. He is a precursor of a far more famous man later on, who writes about Vatke and refers to him as a Hegelian thinker. A Hegelian thinker who wrote a book in 1835 in which he said that the Pentateuch was the result of a development. That, of course, after all, we have to recognize one of two things is true. The Pentateuch was given us by the Lord. Moses tells us what the Lord said, or the Pentateuch is a result of a development. Now, of course, if it was given us by the Lord, that doesn't mean there is no development. The words used in it are words which had developed in human speech. The laws in it are not absolutely new. People never heard before that it was wrong to murder until Moses told us that we mustn't murder. People never before tried to work out schemes of handling property so that people would have some system on which to settle their differences. People had been struggling with these problems for generations. And so we have developments in all these lines. And the Pentateuch is not entirely something new, but it is a presentation of God's will in relation to these things. Of God's will for his people immediately in the wilderness, of God's will for his people more fully in the time in Palestine, and of God's will for his people through all the ages to come. So when you say it is a revelation from God, you don't rule out that there are areas in which development enters in. I think that's an error that Christian people also easily fall into. We get a great truth, and we stand on it. And then we say this truth excludes everything except itself. And we thereby exclude a great deal of other truth, and then eventually we get into an absurd position, and there comes a natural swing way over to the other extreme, which is far worse than the extreme we went to. But the cause of the Lord is honored by finding the truth, not taking an extreme position, which is not exactly in line with God's truth. But here we have then this theory by which there was no revelation from God. It was a development, and it simply represents human development, Hegelian principles, evolutionary lines of progress. A development, but comparatively few people paid much attention to Vatke. That is an interesting thing. You can go out and you can get the support of multitude with any kind of a wild theory you want to present, if you present it forcefully enough and perseveringly enough and self-sacrificially enough to do so. Or you can think things through and present things in logical fashion and maybe affect very few people. But you may affect some who will affect the whole generation that follows. And Vatke is in this area. He did not have any great immediate influence. Number three are George and Ruth. Now be sure you put the and in between because this is two men. The same year in which Vatke wrote his book in 1835, Ruth also wrote a book presenting developmental ideas. Yes? R-E-U-S-S? Yes. But George was the one who wrote the book in 1835. Ruth did not publish a book on his theory. But Ruth, in 1833, 2 years before George published and Vatke published their books, in 1833, Professor Ruth, who was professor at the University of Strasbourg, presented the theory by which the Pentateuch was entirely the result of a process of development, and from it we could learn something of details of the development of ideas and thoughts and institutions, but in itself there was very little of dependable history in it. But Ruth gave these theories in 1833 and wrote a book about them, but his book was not published until 1879. So Ruth had very considerable influence upon his students, but very little other influence. He did not write anything that received immediate attention. The number four, we will mention K.H. Groff. Karl Heinrich Groff, G-R-A-F, K.H. Groff. Now, Groff was a pupil of Ruth. And in 1866, Groff took the theories he had learned from Ruth and he tried to fit them together with documentary theory to show how the Pentateuch would have developed. And he took Hupfeld's documentary theory as his base. And in 1866, Groff published a book, which was the beginning of the union of these two movements, the partition theory movement and the development movement. And we will look at that development separately, the combination of the two, but first say a little bit more about this development theory. So capital B will be its reconstruction of the history of Israel. Capital B, its reconstruction of the history of Israel. Yes? Vatsky and George both published books which presented development theory and affected a number of scholars in this direction. Groff is the one who had the big influence. And these are precursors of Groff. I put the two together because they were about the same time and they did not have a great influence except upon other scholars. But through Groff, they had tremendous influence later on. Now, capital B is its reconstruction of the history of Israel. Under this, number one, the development theory holds that the Pentateuch is a result, or that the history of Israel is a result, or the foundation of the religion of Israel is a result of a natural process. Small a, it is a process from simple to complex. You have in early days people simply showing their gratitude to the deity, real or imagined, by taking some food and offering to the deity. A simple offering that any head of a family can make. A simple beginning. But eventually you have it developing into a complicated ritual in which you have priests who do the sacrificing and go through all kinds of forms and ceremonies, a very involved ritual. And you go through a process from this simple beginning to this complicated situation. You have in many aspects, according to development theory, simple beginnings leading on, gradually becoming enlarged and more involved, more extensive, and eventually reaching a very complicated picture such as we find in the book of Leviticus. And small b under this, it believes in Hegelian development. Hegelian, yes?
Small b,
capital A was its general course. That was just before Devetti. See, Devetti was one under A. Capital 4 was rise of the development theory. And under that, capital A is its general course. I didn't mention that last time. I inserted it now. The record skipped about two lines last time where it should have given you the A. But you see, I went on to one last time. Yes?
What's wrong with the statement that the root of Israel is a process coming through a complex state? The thing that is wrong with that is that we believe that there is development, but
we believe that the great teachings of the Bible are a revelation given by God directly. That's what was wrong. We believe there is natural development. It's all about us. It's in every one of us. Every one of us is to a great extent the result of the forces and circumstances that have affected us in the past. But if we believe in Christ, there's something far more important than that. The Lord has had a direct relationship to us, and we have received His revelation through the Word. And thus we have what is far more important to us is our direct relation with God. But there is development, there is progress all around us. It isn't so much that there is development, there is progress, but that is all there is. That that is all there is, and that everything in the Bible can be explained on such a basis. And small b, Hegelian development. You have, according to Hegel's theories, you have some view, some attitude, some institution, some system, and it brings into existence its antithesis. So you have the thesis and then the antithesis. And these two fight with each other. And out of the fight, eventually a compromise is reached, which you call the synthesis. And this synthesis, in turn, becomes a thesis which produces a new antithesis. And so you have a constant process and progress according to Hegelian ideas. And there is no doubt that there is a certain amount of that in life. But that is anywhere near as simple or as regular as Hegel held, or that is anywhere near as vital a factor in life as he held, is something that would be very difficult to prove. But they felt that everything in the Bible, and we're speaking now particularly of the Pentateuch, must be explainable by natural processes. And these natural processes would be, to a large extent, along these lines, simple to complex and in accordance with Hegelian principles. Now, number two, this reconstruction of the history of Israel that developed in line with the development theory held that before the law was written, there were prophets. They put the prophets ahead of the law instead of after it, as the Bible does. The Bible shows Moses giving the law and then the prophets later. But they said the law is a result of a complex process in which the prophets played a great part. And so the prophets came before the law. This is one of their foundation principles. So the prophets are before the law. And then number three, the law represents itself, a long development. The law represents a long development. Now we have then the law in the Pentateuch. But this Pentateuch, according to them, has very early portions which present the fire god of Mount Sinai going around destroying anybody that gets in his way, the tribal gods that were believed in by different early peoples, all these very primitive ideas. And it also has some very advanced and lofty ideas about the one great God who controls all things. And then it has other phases in between. And so if we can rearrange it in line with this development, it gives us an idea how it came into existence. And they based their arguments to a large extent, not so much like the partition theory largely did, on the narrative portion, rather on the legal portion to a very great extent. And so they said the law, particularly the legal portion, represent a long development. And when they look for the early portion of that development, there we will, in general at this point, simply represent three main phases of this development. Small a, the simple law of the covenant. The simple law found in Exodus 20 to 23. Just the simple earliest law of Israel. Itself, of course, the result of a long development, according to their ideas, but the earliest main phase of law in the Pentateuch would then be the law given at Mount Sinai in Exodus 20 to 23. The simple law of the covenant. According to this law, any head of a family can sacrifice. And he simply offers a simple sacrifice to the deity. There's no detailed form, ritual, anything like that involved in it. And he can do it anyway. Then there is the more complex law, small b, the more complex law of Deuteronomy. And in Deuteronomy, it is no longer every head of a family who can make sacrifices. By the time you get to Deuteronomy, they are trying to centralize all sacrifice in Jerusalem. They are doing away with the high places outside where they worship the Lord, like where Elijah had worshiped the Lord. Over where he had rebuilt the altar that had fallen down and sacrificed upon it over at Mount Carmel. They are doing away with all of these other altars and trying to centralize all the worship in one place where they can control it. And they no longer allow every member of a family to sacrifice. It is every head of a family to sacrifice. It's only the members of a certain group they call the Levite. And so you see how more complex this is than the simple law of the Book of the Covenant. And then small c, the fully developed and involved priestly code, which you find largely in the book of Leviticus. The extensive ritual, the many types of sacrifice, only at one place, not at these various altars where Elijah and others have made sacrifices, and it is a sacrifice which can no longer be done by the head of a family. No longer be done by all the Levites, just by a very few, the priestly family of Aaron. And so you have this development along different lines according to this development theory. Now we have gone somewhat extensively showing how the partition theory developed. And we have very sketchily gone through the main lines of the development theory. Because the partition theory during those years had a fairly wide influence. There were professors in England, in France, in America, as well as in Germany who were presenting these aspects of partition theory, though it did not affect the great mass of ministers at all during those years. The development theory affected far less people, but it got a big push forward when Darwin's book on evolution was published and when evolution began to be widely taught and people began to say, look, see how the Bible is not a revelation of God, it is the result of an evolutionary process which occurred during this period, which we speak. But now we have these two different movements coming together. And so, Roman numeral 5, we will call the Groff-Kühnen-Wellhausen theory. The Groff-Kühnen-Wellhausen theory. Now, Groff, as you know, is capital G-R-A-F. And you might make a hyphen after that and then say Kühnen is capital K-U-E-N-E-N, Kühnen. And then another dash, and then Wellhausen, W-E-L-L-H-A-U-S-E-N. Now when people write extensive, careful, scholarly books, they are apt to speak of the Groff-Kühnen-Wellhausen theory. When people deal in a somewhat more popular way, they speak simply of the Groff-Wellhausen theory. And when they speak in very simple terms, they simply call it the Wellhausen theory. But these three different ways are used to refer to this theory, which is to this day the dominant theory regarding the Pentateuch. Now, when I was in the trial at Seattle about the teaching of the higher criticism in the University of Washington, they had a professor there from Harvard University on the side of the defense, and they asked him, are you familiar with the Groff-Wellhausen theory? And he said, yes. And they said, what do you think of it? And he said, I deny it. But as he went on, it became clear that he was trying to deny many elements of the developmental part of the theory while holding rigidly to the partition part of the theory. And if you hold to the partition part of the theory, it has just about as destructive an effect on faith as if you hold to the whole thing. And yet, he tried to abandon the name Groff-Wellhausen while holding to the whole documentary theory as advanced by Wellhausen. Well, it is today one of the most powerful forces actually in religious thought in the world today. And of the books which are published year after year in almost any language, you find that either there are many which either directly present the Groff-Wellhausen theory or which imply it or assume it in what they say. And so we want to look at capital A, its founders. Its founders. And here we have a very interesting development. In the time of Groff, we'll call number one Groff. In the time of Groff, as you know, in 1866, when he wrote his book, most critical scholars, that is, held to the supplement hypothesis. And according to the supplement hypothesis, you have the whole Elohist document, which was early. And then you have the Jehovah's making his additions or supplements to it. But according to Hopewell's idea, there are not two original documents there, but three, if you include Deuteronomy 4. And they would say that the earliest of these is the first Elohist, which later came to be called P. So we might as well use that term now, though they didn't use it that early. P was the earliest document. P, as you know, includes the first chapter of Genesis. It includes sections through Genesis, extensive sections, up till Genesis 20, and very little in the rest of Genesis. Includes some portions of the early part of Exodus, and then all of the latter portions, the very last third of Exodus and most of Leviticus. P, then, was the earliest written, according to this view. And then next would either be J or E, the second Elohist. There might be some difference which of those two was first, but they would come later than P. And then, of course, the last of the documents to be written was Deuteronomy, which they called D, and eventually somebody simply took these four and united them together and made the Pentateuch. Well, the Gruff tried to take Hopewell's theory and fit it in with the development theory. And Gruff said in 1866, he said, yes, as far as Genesis is concerned, you have first the first Elohist, which later is called P. Then you have the second Elohist, and J, one or other, and then you have Deuteronomy. But he said, when you get into the laws from the middle part of Exodus on, he said, you find these involved, intricate, complicated laws, which Hopewell considered were part of the first Elohist. And he said, these are advanced, these are not early, these are late. So he says, these come even after Deuteronomy. And he wrote his book to present this view in 1866. Yes? The laws of Leviticus and those related to them. The involved, complicated laws which were considered part of the first Elohist. Number two is Kuenen, capital K-U-E-N-E-N, professor at the University of Leiden in Holland. And Kuenen, with that thoroughness, taking a point and carrying it to the very limit, which is so often typical of the Dutch scholars, Kuenen criticized Groth's book. He said, Groth is right. He said, the complicated laws of Leviticus cannot be earlier than the simpler laws of Exodus 20 to 23 and of Deuteronomy. They must be late, but he said, when Groth tries to separate the first Elohist into two parts and say its narrative in Genesis is early and its laws in Leviticus and these other parts are late, he is attempting the impossible. Look at Genesis 1, in the beginning, day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4. God saw it was good. God saw it was good. God saw it was good. It was evening, it was morning. This regular, steady, numerical, statistical sort of arrangement. And then he says, look at these laws in A. Leviticus. You shall take this part and do this, and this part and do this, and this part and do this, and this part and do this. That is the law of this kind of sacrifice. You shall take this part and do this, this part and do this, this part and do this, this part and do this. That's the law of this kind of sacrifice. He says, you can't separate these. These are the same document. But he said, Groth is right. These laws cannot be the earliest part of the Pentateuch. They are the latest. He said, also, Genesis 1 and these narrative portions of the Pentateuch, which they call the first Elohist, they also must be late. And some people said, Kuenen is attempting to make a Copernican revolution. You know, Copernicus was given credit for having changed the idea that the earth was at the center and the sun revolved around it to the idea that the sun was at the center of the universe and the earth revolved around it. And they said, this is just like that. It's a complete revolution. You take the very earliest, Genesis 1, and you make it the very latest. So they said, there's a Copernican revolution in what Keenan presents. And so in 1869, Keenan presented this theory, and Groth said, that's right. He said, Keenan has made an improvement on what I presented. But it was nearly 20 years more before any great number of scholars accepted this very extreme idea that seemed to them to be of turning the whole thing around in this way. Yes?
Did you say then that one of the documents is actually earlier or later than previously?
He is taking what was previously thought to be the earliest document and making it the very latest. The Copernican Revolution, what for 80 years all scholars of this view, all partition scholars held, this is the very earliest, this is the beginning. This is the general structure of the book of Genesis into which the J document has been fitted. You may question whether the J document is a complete document, but that the P document is, there's no question of that. That's the earliest, that's the foundation. The others fit it into it. He takes that and puts it at the very end. And says, that's written last of all. That represents the complicated last stage of the development instead of the first stage. And so Groth accepted Keenan's suggestion. But for nearly 20 years more, most critical scholars disagreed. And the fact that they changed their minds is due to number three, Julius Wellhausen. Julius, J-U-L-I-U-S, Wellhausen, W-E-L-L-H-A-U-S-E-N, a very great mind, a scholar with a tremendously wide knowledge, skilled in languages, background of a tremendous amount of knowledge, very great mind, a very able teacher, and most unusual of all for a German scholar, he could write simple language that could be easily understood. Whereas most of these other scholars would begin a sentence and you might have to look through half a page or more to get the verb, which would come perhaps at the end of the sentence. Julius Wellhausen wrote shorter and clearer sentences, and his ideas could reach not merely the scholars, but the great mass of people. He was a man of attractive personality and great personal charm. My professor, under whom I studied at Princeton, Professor Robert Dick Wilson, who was very subject to seasickness if he ever got on a boat, said Wellhausen was a wonderful man to have around to hold your head when you were sick. He had a charm about him and a helpfulness which made people interested in what he had to say. And he said it in a way that was clear and easy to understand. And he took these views, he made very little change in them. There's very little in the theory that you can say is Wellhausen's change or improvement or anything, but he presented it in a way that won acceptation. And so it is not wrong to call it the Wellhausen theory, though it is more accurate to call it the Groth-Wellhausen, because Groth had most of the ideas long before Wellhausen, but it's still more accurate to call it the Groth-Kuhnen-Wellhausen theory, because Kuhnen made a very substantial and important improvement in Groth's first idea to make it far easier to defend. And so Julius Wellhausen, who was born in 1844 and died in 1918, published in 1885 a series of articles, which then appeared in book form in German, called Die Komposition des Hexateuchs. In English it'd be The Composition of the Hexateuch. So far as I know, it has never been translated into English. And it seems strange, because Wellhausen came to have such a tremendous influence, but I have never heard of anybody except myself and my associates having translated this book into English, and I've never heard of an English translation of it having been published. How much influence it had in Germany, I don't know. His book, The Composition of the Hexateuch. But it was his next book, which appeared in 1878, No, that's earlier, isn't it? 1878 is a little early. I guess his composition was a later presentation as applied to the arrangement of them. But his book in, the composition was, but his Prolegomena, as it's come to be called, it was at first called The History of Israel. But when translated into English, they call it the Prolegomena to the History of Israel. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the word prolegomena, P-R-O-L-O-G-O-M-E-N-A. It means preliminary principles, foundation principles for the understanding of. And it gave the impression, when you say prolegomena of the History of Israel, that it was the first volume to be succeeded by other volumes. But it's the only one that ever appeared, but it's been translated several times into English, gone through a good many publications in English, been translated into other languages as well, and his Prolegomena in 1878, Prolegomena to the History of Israel, presented in a popular way, and yet a scholarly way, but a way that could be understood by most people, the idea of the development of Israelite religion according to a process from the simple to the complex, from very simple primitive ideas to very advanced and lofty ideas, and by a Hegelian process of the interplay of various forces. And this book had a tremendous influence. So great that we will devote number B, capital B, to the spread of the theory. The spread of the theory. Number one, its rapid spread. Number one, its rapid spread. This theory, when Wellhausen presented his book, all the younger scholars knew, immediately said, this is the answer to it. Here is the true explanation of how the religion of Israel came into existence. Some of the older scholars who believed in the critical theories, some of them refused to accept his view, still held to the supplementary theory or to Hupfeld with the earlier arrangement of documents. But as these older scholars died off, the younger ones, all of them, accepted Wellhausen's presentation. It had a very strong supporter in Professor Robertson Smith, professor in the University of Aberdeen, editor of the Encyclopedia Britannica, a great mind, a tremendous influence in British thought. The Free Church of Scotland put Professor Smith on trial for his teaching of the Wellhausen theory in his classes in Aberdeen. He was removed from his professorship, and he then was called to the University of Cambridge, where he would have a greater influence in spreading his theories throughout the English-speaking world. The professors in the English universities, most of whom had paid little attention to the previous theory, came over to a great extent to the Wellhausen theory, and it spread like wildfire through the Christian world. Now, that was one, its rapid spread under capital B. Number two, its present vogue. Now, various men will say today, the Groth-Wellhausen theory, who holds that anymore? That's out of date. We don't believe in unilinear evolution of the religion of Israel anymore. But you ask them, do you believe the Pentateuch was written by one author? Oh, no, of course not. We believe in the J, E, D, and P documents, which were combined and so on. They believe in practically all that Wellhausen taught, even if they reject the name Wellhausen. You take the popular books that are written today on the Old Testament, and the great majority of them present the theories of the Wellhausen reconstruction of history, whether they use his name or not. And you take scholars today who are important in the archaeological or field or in the Old Testament field. Take a man like Professor Albright of Johns Hopkins University, and he will assume in all his writings that J is the earliest document and that P is the latest document. And he, wherever he refers to them, it's very clear that he accepts the main lines of the documentary theory as held by Wellhausen. This is appearing in book after book and is taught in high school courses and in general history books, in literature books, and in courses in religion. In most theological seminaries that are over 40 years old, and in almost every university in the world, wherever anything is taught about the Bible. It should be noted, and we will before the end of the year, that there are scholars today who are doing first-hand work from a critical viewpoint in the Old Testament who have made great changes in the Wellhausen theory. Some have changed it tremendously in one direction, some in another direction, and they've written scholarly books on these subjects, and they argue back and forth, and they are held in high esteem by the other scholars who still hold exactly to this view. But they are having comparatively little influence as yet. Actually, their theories are, if anything, worse than the Wellhausen theory rather than better. But they are quite different in many regards. But they are not having any wide general influence as yet, though it is true that the majority of really scholarly books on the Old Testament today that go into detail by men who have delved a great deal into these matters differ on many vital points from the Wellhausen theory. But their ideas aren't getting into general books, or even books by a man like Dr. Albright, who will turn to these other theories and rather speak very scathingly of them as if they're rather crazy divergencies from the clear truths of the J.E. and D.P. development. So when somebody tells you, why talk about the Groth-Wellhausen theory? It's out of date. Nobody believes it anymore. Don't pay any attention to what they say, because the fact is that it is being widely taught and assumed in the books on the Old Testament, in practically all books on it, that are not written from a strictly fundamental viewpoint today, whether they use the name or not. And therefore, it is important that we know something about the theory, even though the theory, as contained in these general books, and as taught, as held by a man like Dr. Albright, has changed hardly any since Wellhausen wrote in 1878. Professor Alice wrote a book about 30 years ago called The Five Books of Moses, in which he took up the Wellhausen theory and looked at many of its aspects and presented a great many excellent arguments against it. And Professor Albright wrote a very long and extensive review of Alice's book, in which he praised certain features of the book. But then, he got more and more disgusted with it, until by the end he was simply panicked. And he says in Alice's book, he has not quoted any authority since 1900. He said, why doesn't he deal with a recent writer? He said, if he really thinks that the matter of the unity of the Pentateuch is as important as he says it is, why doesn't he do some work on it? Well, I thought Albright was very, very extreme and unreasonable in his attack on Alice's book, because the theory as it is held today is practically the same as it was presented in 1900. And if we know the facts about that, we know the facts about that which is today being generally presented. But it is also a fact that there are new developments, any one of which may one of these days come into its own as a tremendously important position, differing somewhat from the Wellhausen theory, but as just as antagonistic to Scripture, if not more so, than the Wellhausen theory. Now, so then, its present vogue is very great. There's no question of that. So now we look at capital C, the bases of the theory. Now, the bases of the theory, as you know, come from two different directions. It is a combination of partition theory with development theory. There are those today who try to throw aside the whole development aspect. Or rather, they say, oh, that's not true, what Wellhausen said. We do not believe in unilinear evolutionary development. They always use the word unilinear. They don't say it's not an evolutionary development. They say we don't believe in unilinear evolutionary development. But they do believe in some kind of a development. They think it was not as simple as Wellhausen presented. But though they try often to push aside this developmental aspect of it, the fact is that the partition idea was crystallized by Groff, Keenan, and Wellhausen into this particular union with a particular theory of development, and the idea of the documents as held today rests upon this, and received its wide acceptance because of its union with it. That was just the time when the evolutionary ideas were being widely disseminated through the world, and this was united with that, and that's what had so much to do to gain its wide acceptation. But now the bases of the theory, as you know then, come from two different directions, partly from the partition arguments and partly from the development arguments. And actually, some of the development arguments, I think, are harder to answer than the partition arguments are. But the emphasis today is on the partition arguments rather than the development arguments, so we will spend more time on them in this class. So as I say, I think the others are actually somewhat harder to answer than they are. But then under C, the basis for the theory, you may say, one, the arguments for partition. Now, there are four arguments for partition. And these four arguments for partition are the same arguments which were advanced for Eichhorn's original theory. As you all know, I trust, these four arguments, because they are tremendously important for the understanding of the Groth-Wellhausen theory. First, it began with the idea of the divine name as being the clue. Some call this Astruc's clue. The clue that where it uses one divine name, it's one author. Where it uses another divine name, it is another author. And this argument has, to this day, tremendous weight in leading people to accept the theory. And so we will take a considerable amount of time in looking at this argument. The second argument is the... Well, before you speak of the second, just one point to notice the relationship of the theory, the Groth-Wellhausen theory, to this argument as compared with Eichhorn's relation. You see how simple it was as Eichhorn presented. You take all the passages that use Elohim, you put them here, all that use Jehovah, and put them here, you got two dots. Very simple. But then you notice, when you carry it on, that after the early chapters of Exodus, they all use Jehovah. So you have to have other divisions after that. This clue is only good in that first portion of the passage. But now you take Hupfeld, and Hupfeld says the first Eloist is actually two different documents. So now the name Elohim no longer gives you a clear clue to one document, because there are two documents, according to this, that use Elohim. So you see how the use of the divine names as a clue is weakened by the Hupfeld change which Wellhausen adopted. Now the second argument, as you know, is the argument for continuous narrative. Originally, they said, the E document is a continuous story. It gives the whole document. You've got everything there. J is insertion, add something here and there, but you don't need J. You've got everything you need. That's what they said. That was your supplement theory. But now Hupfeld says you take the E document and practically all of it in Genesis after Genesis 20 isn't part of it at all. It's a different document. So your P document, as they call it now, actually is very, very incomplete from Genesis 20 on up to the middle of Exodus. So your complete document theory, originally we have two complete documents, and they said, no, we have one complete document. P and J is just addition. Now we take P and we divide it, or E and we divide it in two parts, P and E, so we say J is the most complete we have, which formerly they questioned how complete it was. And these other two, well, they're less complete than J. You see how the second argument is weakened greatly over what it was as Eichhorn presented. Now the third argument is the argument from parallel passages, as you know. You find something said here and you find it said here. They must be two different documents. Why would one man say the same thing twice? Now we find that we have three documents, or four if you count Deuteronomy, and then pretty soon we find more parallels and more parallels and more parallels. And if you carry this on indefinitely, you get, of course, back to the fragment hypothesis. And then the fourth argument is the differences of viewpoint, of style, of approach, and of idea, and so on. Well, now, this could include the first argument, except the first argument is where it all started, so we keep it separate because of the greater prominence that was given to it. But this fourth argument, you have this long document, P. Now, look at the style of it. Have you got a continuous, definite style here?
And then a different style in J? Well, now along comes Hochfeld and says after Genesis 20, practically all of the Elohist is much more like the style of J than the style of P. What does that do to your impression of the perspicacity of those men who said there was a uniform style all through the original? When he says that all this great part of it is entirely different from the rest and much more like the style of Jet. And if you have a long section by an author, you can look it through and see what he does and what he doesn't do and make some definite rules what his style is. But when you cut it up, you have less material on which to construct a definite idea as to what that style is. So you see, of these four arguments, three of them would seem to be rather definitely weakened by Hochfeld's change over the approach that Eichhorn had taken. Well, now so much for the moment for the argument for partition. Number two is the argument for development. And we are not going to say nearly as much about the arguments for development as about the partition arguments, because our time is limited and there's much more difference of opinion about this today than there is about the partition. But the first of these four arguments for development would be the claim that there are discrepancies. We might call that A now, that there are discrepancies. That is to say, they say that one document permits any head of a family to sacrifice. Another document restricts sacrifice to the Levite. And another document restricts it still further to just the family of Aaron. See, any head of a family, Levite, just the priest. You see the difference, the discrepancy between them. And the claim is that there are differences between the documents. There are contradictions. One of the documents says that Moses took a pair of every kind of animal into the ark. The other document says he took seven pairs of each of the clean animals into the ark. And they give hundreds of cases where they claim there is a discrepancy between the documents. Well, now, discrepancies, if shown, would not necessarily prove the document. But the second argument goes much further in that direction. The argument that there is a logical process in the difference. Thus, you take the earliest document, and it represents God in human terms. It's anthropomorphic. God speaks, he touches, he handles. There's God's face, there's God's arm, there's God's hand. It's anthropomorphic. The next one is not anthropomorphic, but anthropopathic. That is to say, it represents God as feeling, as weeping, as being sorrowful, as being glad. He has the feelings of man, but it doesn't represent him as doing the actions of man. You see, it is less primitive, according to that. Yes? Anthropopathic. Yes. And then the next one is... God is still more, less of a human figure. And then you take the last one, P, and God says, let there be light. He speaks and it is done. This great, lofty idea of a God who does not move, who does not feel, who's just a fixed, immovable something that speaks and it is done. An idea far less human, far less moving, far less emotional, but they would say far more advanced, more abstract, representing a later development. So the idea of logical process. Now, we can't mention the last two, or somebody might be late to chapel, and I wouldn't want anybody to be on account of this class. So we'll stop until tomorrow morning.